Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Grey Matter. Well, I don't watch television very much anymore, but when I used to, one of my favorite shows was called Mythbusters. You might remember the show. They would take apart some machine or something like that and see whether something that was accepted as an urban myth or in common parlance was actually true. Well, today's show is another in a series that we've been doing on science and medicine, but the theme really today is going to be myth busting. We have a very esteemed guest, Dr. Patrick Moore, on, and he's an astrophysicist. He's written a number of books. We're going to talk about especially his most recent book, which explodes just about every myth that's out there about climate change and especially climate catastrophe. And in his most recent book, he takes these apart piece by piece, bit by bit, I cannot recommend this book enough for anyone who's out there thinking that the sun god is going to destroy us. But before we get to him and introduce him properly, as we always do, we're going to go to our aphorisms board, and again, these are somewhat in our guest's honor. The first one is from a 20th century philosopher named Bertrand Russell, who once wrote, "Science does not aim at establishing immutable truths and eternal dogmas. Its aim is to approach the truth by successive approximations without claiming that at any stage, final and complete accuracy has been achieved." The next one is from a somewhat older scientist or philosopher, Nicholas Copernicus, who wrote that to know that we know what we know and to know what we do not know, what we do not know, that is true knowledge. See if you can figure that one out. The next one is from an author that I think that both our guest and myself admired, the late Michael Crichton, who was quoted as saying, "We need to get environmentalism out of the sphere of religion. We need to stop the mythic fantasies. And we need to stop the doomsday predictions. We need to start doing hard science instead." And finally, from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, "We know they are lying. They know they are lying. They know that we know they are lying. We know that they know we know they are lying. And still they continue to lie." And one more, and this is from our esteemed guest, who once wrote, "I love nature and people are part of nature. All people and all living things. I believe in one human family, and that requires international communication and trade. Bioregionalism should not be used as an excuse for isolationism. All watersheds are connected. Environmentalism must be beyond nationalism, politics, and ideology. Biocentrism, life-centered thinking, is not the opposite of anthropocentrism, human-centered thinking. People are part of life. Renewability and sustainability are strongly linked. Trees and wood are both good!" Exclamation point. "A world without forests is as unthinkable as a day without wood. There are at least as many positive trends in the world as there are negative ones. We are no more headed for doomsday than we are for nirvana, unless a large asteroid hits the Earth, in which case we will go to both places simultaneously." Just brilliant.
I love that one myself. I forgot about that.
Welcome to the show, Professor Moore. I just want to go a little bit more into your background here. There's a bit of a bio here about you. Lifelong independent scientist and environmentalist, co-founder of Greenpeace in 1971, director for 15 years, a leader of many campaigns, including ending nuclear weapons testing, saving the whales, and ending toxic dumping. In the mid-1980s, you became disenchanted with the positions of his fellow Greenpeace directors, using misinformation, sensation, and fear for fundraising instead of using valid science. So you struck out on your own, determined to be a sensible environmentalist. That might be an oxymoron in some cases, basing policies on sound science and balancing environmental, social, and economic priorities. You are a humanitarian environmentalist who believes people are not the enemy of the environment, but rather an integral part of living creation with a responsibility for both ourselves and all nature. Does that sound accurate to you? Is that an accurate description of yourself?
Pretty close.
Excellent. So, It's difficult to know where to start with you because you've had such a long and distinguished career. But maybe we'll start here. There's a piece that that came out earlier this week. Then this was published in the Western Standard, a publication you might be familiar with.
Yes.
And this says Health Canada releases a report about public health action against climate change. So apparently Dr. Tam, who appears to be not much of an expert on health, based upon her complete and utter mismanagement of COVID-19, is now an expert on the environment. And apparently she's championing this cause of the Canadian government, which says that now the greatest threat to us is this environmental catastrophe. Is this the new wave, Dr. Moore? Is this what we can expect now from the Canadian government and the globalists, that we're going to be facing this threat of environmental catastrophe?
Yes, millions will die, apparently, if we use fossil fuels. And when on the other hand, the use of fossil fuels, both for energy and for the production of our most important fertilizer, which is nitrogen fertilizer, where we combine natural gas with nitrogen, you'll find that in many cases, such as the case against plastic, which is almost all made from fossil fuels, that the war on plastic is just a proxy for the war on fossil fuels. And the same thing goes for this conflation of medicine and climate change somehow. You just have to go to the fact that humans are a tropical species, if we're talking about human health here rather than the general health of the planet, which is a different matter because some species actually evolved in cold climates. Penguins, for example, they evolved from species that were not in a cold climate, but then when the Earth cooled down into this Pleistocene ice age after 250 million years of being warm with no ice on either pole. See, that's what a lot of people don't understand. It was only 2.5 million years ago that the ice really set in the Arctic. It set in earlier than that in the Antarctic because it's colder there. But through most of the history of modern life, the Arctic and the Antarctic have been ice-free. And so there weren't any penguins standing on ice floes if there was no ice. And there were no polar bears hunting seals through their breathing holes in the ice if there was no ice. It's very obvious that that couldn't have happened. So we are a tropical species. We evolved at the equator quite recently in terms of evolution. If you believe it, we evolved from ape-like animals beginning some millions of years ago through a long succession of development to where we ended up looking like we do today, losing most of our fur because we were in a tropical climate and all you needed was some other animal's fur at night to keep you from getting cold. Humans could never have come out of the equatorial climate if it weren't for fire, shelter, and clothing, which other species generally do not have, although many animals that live in cold climates burrow into the ground and hibernate over the winter in order to avoid the cold. But the truth of the matter is, ice is the enemy of life, cold is the enemy of life, and warmth is the friend of life. If you look at the tropical forests, they have more biodiversity than anywhere else on the entire planet. In other words, more species have found it possible to survive there than on the North Pole or the Antarctica. There's more species in Antarctica, largely because it's an ocean. And so many of the species that live there are marine species, where you have a completely different climate than you do above the sea level. And so if all you have to do is just think of that the fact that the Arctic and the Antarctic support so few species compared to the tropical part of the world, to know where it is best for life. It's as simple as that. That doesn't mean we shouldn't care about the species that have somehow managed to adapt themselves to these really cold climates in one way or another. The polar bear has this massive fat layer and a huge fur, and they are able, therefore, to live through 6 months of no sun when they go out
people don't, a lot of people don't understand that it's black and white in the above the Arctic Circle and the Antarctic Circle, that when you're there, you get 24 hours of sun for 6 months, and then you get no sun for 6 months. That's why it's unlikely that it's going to thaw out anytime soon, because there are 6 months with no sun. And it's amazing, actually, that it thaws as much as it does in the summer. And if it didn't thaw in the summer, in the winter, even now, people think the ice is disappearing up there. In the winter now, the Arctic is 100% covered in ice. And in addition to that, a large perimeter outside the Arctic Circle is covered. The whole of Hudson's Bay, none of which is in above the Arctic Circle, freezes every winter. And so do the Bering Sea. Most of it freezes in the winter, and it's not above the Arctic Circle. So the ice extends out far beyond the Arctic Circle in the winter. And that's when the bears depend on the ice for hunting seals. They don't hunt seals in the summer because the seals aren't giving birth then, and many other reasons, but they go on the land in the summer when the ice recedes and the Arctic islands actually lose their snow cover, and some berries actually grow there. Not much, but some do. And polar bears will eat kelp in the summer in the tidal areas. So they get by, but by and large, the tropics are by far the most suitable climate for life, just given the an inordinate number of species that survive there compared to every time you go further north. And the real cutoff is where there's ice, frost. Mm-hmm. In mm-hmm. As soon as you get a climate with frost, the number of species just gets cut into a few percent of what it is where there is no frost, because, you know, some plants have learned to live in sub-zero temperatures, of course, because, say, on the Mackenzie Delta, where it's going to go down to 40, 50 below in the winter, the needles of those coniferous trees that manage to live there, because they keep their needles all through the winter, and that's where their photosynthetic apparatus is. It's a very complicated thing, a needle of a tree. They take all the water out of inside their cells and put it into the intercellular space where there's no organs or anything. It's just a space between the cells. And there it can freeze without causing damage to the organelles, the chloroplast and the mitochondria and the other things that are inside the cell, which are tissues and, you know, they're complicated chemical things that if they froze, they'd die. But they make basically a gel, which is an antifreeze inside the cell. And therefore, the tree can live through the winter. And in the summer, the water is absorbed back into the cell and it comes alive again. So it's a type of hibernation for the needle of a tree. Every needle on those trees, which is how many millions of needles are doing that every winter. It's really cool. But that's the type of thing that life has had to do to survive freezing temperatures, which are not good generally. They're generally a negative factor. And I'm living here on Vancouver Island, just a little over halfway to the North Pole from the equator. And there's many species of life that simply could not live here because it's too cold. And the only reason I can live here is because I have a house with a heater in it. It's close to our outside.
Well, that you've already exploded a couple of myths that many people have about climate change. And we're going to get into these in more detail and talk about your book, Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom. But before we do that, there's a couple of things that maybe by way of background that I'll ask you to talk about, Dr. Moore. Firstly, one of these is that you've talked about adaptation, which the climate catastrophists that don't seem to think human beings have any ability to adapt. But that seems to be maybe the main feature of human beings and really of all life, as you just described. But the other thing is, I'm curious to know, how did we arrive at this idea that human beings are the enemies of the planet? In that quotation when I quoted you off the top, you emphasized that human beings are part of life. We're part of the biosphere. We're part of this planet. But the people who are scaring us with this climate catastrophe seem to view us as some sort of aliens who arrived from some foreign place and that we're destroying the planet, and they sort of put the planet ahead of human beings. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because I'm curious to know how that idea started.
Yes, it is really unfortunate that people don't recognize the good that humans have done just during the industrial era. I mean, this is a whole new thing. It only goes back to 1800, 1750, around there, when industrial culture emerged. So we're very new at it. But, and at first, this has been very well proven. At first, we made a lot of pollution. We over harvested the forests. We did a lot of things that were negative from the point of view of sustainability. But in recent times, we have reversed most of those trends. Here's one of my favorite ones: is the whole of Europe, all those highly technological countries, by about 1750 to 1800, had reduced the area of forest to less than 10% of the whole of Europe, whereas it had been 40% or more before that. And this was because wood was used for every source of energy, for heating all the buildings, for steel mills and glass works and steam engines and running trains and all the things that needed energy was all supplied by wood. So the forests were depleted. So the combination of moving to fossil fuels, which are basically coal especially, is wood that has been preserved in the ground and turned into a hydrocarbon by the pressure and the heat. That's what we're using now. And as a result, we still use a lot of wood, but because the forests were depleted, smart people realized that they needed to learn how to grow trees and how to breed trees and how to plant trees and in other words, how to renew the forest after they'd cut it. And that is why silviculture began in Europe, the science of growing trees as opposed to food, which started 10,000 years ago. But no one had to figure out how to grow trees because there were so many of them and all over the world so abundant that nowhere else except that original technological civilization that evolved in Europe had depleted them yet. And so today there's 43% forest cover in Europe from less than 10% a couple of hundred years ago. And those forests are perfectly healthy. They are full of biodiversity. They're managed, most of them. There are wild forests in Europe as well. Most of them are managed. But the beauty of forestry is foresters don't mind other species being in there. Whereas farmers growing wheat and corn, they don't like any other species hardly. I mean, there are some that are benign, but most of them are there to try to eat their crops. And whether it's insects or animals and or birds, I mean, everything, right? So farming does produce a fairly sterile environment from that point of view. But we have created more forest in the last 100 years than most people would believe. China and India, where we think there's too many people, have actually created 50% of all the new forests that have been planted in the last 20 years or so. It's a big movement all around the world to prevent deforestation and to create reforestation where it was. So we're not causing the people who live in the cities have been, unfortunately, and there's now the majority of people live in urban environments. They really don't understand much about what's going on out in the countryside. And they have been brainwashed into thinking that the people who are cutting trees, drilling for oil, blowing up mountains to get copper and iron and all the other thing, and fishing and all the other things that people do to get the resources in the countryside, they fail to recognize the fact that there wouldn't be a city if people weren't creating concrete and steel and glass and aluminum and asphalt and all the other things that go into creating the infrastructure. People seem to be in favor of infrastructure. They even call legislation infrastructure when it really has very little to do with it, in order to make it seem like a good thing. And, you know, it's sort of like the Inflation Reduction Act, you know. And so people are really confused. I mean, you can understand why, but a person living on the 30th floor of a condominium cannot grow enough food on their balcony to feed themselves, especially if it's facing north. So, you know, but meanwhile, while they're sleeping, the trucks come in from the farms with the food to restock the shelves in the supermarket downstairs. And they go down there in the morning and wow, the place is full of food. How'd that happen? And so there's many ways to describe that headspace, but the urban environment is basically being been brainwashed by the so-called environmental movement, because it's today a radical political movement, and economics has a lot more to do with it than when we were volunteers saving the whales back in the day. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was a lot of people who just gave up having a normal life and went out to stop the nuclear war threat and stop the whale slaughter and all those things. And we did that because we could see that those were really important things to do. But nowadays, people are you know, and they believe there's a garbage patch twice the size of Texas in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, when it's a complete and utter myth. There is absolutely no such thing.
So that's one of the ones in your book that really, of course, I was very pleased to learn that that's a hoax, but also shocked, because we're not. And one of the great things about your book, I should say, is that everything that is in your book is very carefully documented. It's based on data. One of the other ones I wanted to ask you about, which is a huge one, obviously, is this threat of carbon. And in preparation for meeting with you today, I did some research, and I read some books by people like Michael Schellenberger and Bjorn Lomborg. And I noticed that although they share some of your ideas about climate change, they still think that climate or that carbon is a problem. But this is one of the big myths that you explode in your book. In fact, you said something quite shocking, and I hope I have this correct, is that actually, were it not for the adaptation of human beings to start harvesting and burning, you know, fossil fuels, that the Earth might very well be in a much more serious climate problem, if there is one, than we have right now. In other words, and I hope I have this right, that the burning of fossil fuels might be staving off an ice age. Do I have that correct, or do I have that close to the mark in terms of what's in your book?
No, not really, because it isn't about the temperature.
Okay.
And one thing I do think that people should understand is that anybody who calls carbon dioxide carbon should not be listened to anymore. Just don't talk to them anymore, because they don't understand what they're talking about, and they're using pure propaganda. That would be like calling water hydrogen. Like, okay, if you haven't got that science, enough science to know that it's not carbon, it's carbon dioxide, and that when you put two elements together, like carbon and oxygen, you get something that is completely different from either one of them by itself. I mean, carbon is soot, is graphite, and is diamonds, and is buckyballs. It's one of the most versatile shapeshifters in the whole atomic spectrum. That's why we give it a special place in science. Organic chemistry is the chemistry of carbon, nothing else. Just the chemistry of carbon. All 91 other elements are inorganic chemistry. And the reason that carbon is described as, the chemistry of carbon is described as organic carbon, is because it is the basis of all life on Earth. There is nothing else that could be described other than hydrogen and oxygen. They are also part of the photosynthetic process, which oxygen, in other words, is given off by the plants, and that's made animal life possible. And the CO2 that was in the atmosphere in the original Earth and has been drastically depleted through time, and that's what you're referring to, is that we've come along at a point in the evolution of the Earth and of life on Earth where CO2 had declined to a level that threatened the existence of life during the most recent glacial maximum. Now, it's really hard to discuss the time scale of this Earth, because it's 4.6 billion years old, and life emerged somewhere between 4 and 3.5 billion years ago. So we're only out by half a billion years in knowing exactly when it started. But there wasn't much to preserve when it started, because for the first 3 billion years of life, say it started 3.5 billion years ago, for the first 3 billion years, all life was unicellular, microscopic, and confined to the sea. And even after that, 500 million years ago, the Cambrian explosion occurred, where multicellular life finally came into existence. And that was because of tissue differentiation, where you could have an organism that had eyes and skin and muscles and stomach and all the other tissues that we have. Because if it's just a blob of all the same molecules, you know, all the same cells, that doesn't do much. And so life exploded at that time. And since then, it has been evolving and came out of the sea 100 million years later. Then forests evolved, and the insects and the birds and the animals and dinosaurs that went extinct, and the ones that survived, which are mostly the birds. And all of that has happened in this hugely long period of time. So let's just go back to, say, 2.5 million years ago, which is when the Arctic froze over. Prior to that, for 250 million years, there was no ice on the Arctic. None.
Wow.
250 million years. Because the previous ice age, and this is the problem with the term ice age, a lot of people think that the most recent glacial advance was the last ice age, when in fact there were more than 40 of those in the last 2.5 million years.
Really?
The ice has come and gone at least 40 times as the Earth has cycled through glacial maximums, the last one of which covered Canada in a mile and more of ice and went all the way down into the northern tier states of the U.S. New York was covered in ice. Montreal had 3 kilometers of ice on it. And up in Hudson's Bay, it was more like 5 kilometers of ice. So those were the glacial maximums, and there were many of them. They came every 100,000 years for the last million years, and before that, the previous 1.6 million years, they came every 40,000 years or so, in concert with the Milankovitch cycles, which are caused by the gravitational effect of Jupiter on the Earth's rotation around the Sun and the tilt of the Earth. That's a 40,000-year cycle. The 100,000-year cycle is the one that affects the shape of the Earth's orbit. Just happens to be coincidentally that those tie in with these cycles. So we do know something about the way the cycles of the Earth work, but we sure don't know everything. Mm-hmm. But what we do know is that CO2 during the most recent glacial advance, which peaked about 18 to 20,000 years ago, CO2 came down to 180 parts per million, which is 0.018%. It's amazing that anything can live when that's its primary food, plants, that is, that's its primary food is CO2. There's plenty of water, but there isn't plenty of CO2 at that point in history. And at 150 parts per million, plants basically start to die. So we came along and created this civilization we have during the last 10,000 years, which is such a blink in the eye of evolution. I mean, it's nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are, right at the time when CO2 is sunk to a really low level, and inadvertently, because we didn't start putting CO2 in the atmosphere to save it from CO2 drought, we did it to get energy.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is, it's probably an even more important thing in the long term. Well, it is a more important thing in the long term, because it's whether there's going to be life on the planet or not, because CO2 had been depleted continuously through the history of life, going back, say, 500 million years, 500 million years, when CO2 was approximately 5,000 parts per million in the atmosphere, and life was just fine with that. As a matter of fact, it thrived.
Mm-hmm.
And it had been depleted. And how was it depleted? Well, fossil fuels are one of the reasons, but not the most reason. Fossil fuels basically are made from life. and the forests sucked CO2 out of the atmosphere and got buried and turned into coal. And the marine life fell to the bottom of the ocean into the sediments and turned into oil and gas. So that carbon was lost to the cycle. There's a cycle in the atmosphere and the oceans and the plants on the land and the plankton in the sea that cycles the carbon. And it just kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller to the point where we came along. It was getting towards being a threat to the existence of life. Now, these are, again, long times. It might have taken a million more years for that to happen, but that's not very long in terms of life's existence.
Mm-hmm. Nothing. Mm-hmm. Fascinating.
But the main cause of the depletion of CO2 in the atmosphere over the ages is calcifying marine species. Calcium carbonate is what the shells of corals and clams and barnacles and oysters, snails, everything that has a shell on it, which was an amazing invention by soft multicellular organisms that were more like jellyfish when they first emerged. The first large species of life didn't have a shell. They were just a blob, basically. The ones that developed a skeleton, internal skeleton, like all of the animals, that was when rigidity started coming into the picture. But that's on the inside. The idea of having a shell on the outside is like a knight in armor. That's what all those species figured out how to do, is to take calcium carbonate made from CO2 and calcium in the ocean. See, this can't be done in the air because there's no calcium in the air. But it can be done in fresh water. It can be done by a snail. Land snails manage to make a shell for themselves. I actually don't know how they get their calcium. I'd like to know that, but it isn't my main pursuit at the moment. But they do get it somehow. And so that calcium carbonate was constantly taking CO2 out of the atmosphere and out of the oceans in particular, and putting it on the bottom of the sea where it remains today. And 8% of the Earth's crust is made of calcium carbonate, which is of life origin. People think limestone is a rock. It is, but it didn't come from a volcano. In the same way, there's sedimentary rock, which is rock that's been ground up in rivers and stuff and ends up making sandstone. But that came originally, most of that came from a volcano. But the limestone, chalk, and marble, the cliffs of Dover, for example, are made from the shells of coccolithophores, which are a microscopic phytoplankton, which are teeming in the sea. That's the basis for the food chain in the ocean, because they're photosynthesizers. Mm-hmm. So the White Cliffs of Dover are made from their skeletons. And so are all the coral reef skeletons. If you think about it, all the coral reefs in the ocean today, like take the Great Barrier Reef, which is great and huge.
One of your myths that's debunked in the book, right? Yes. One of the myths, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, they just announced this year, actually, they had to do it because they can't hide this anymore, that the coral cover on the Great Barrier Reef this year is higher than they've ever seen it in the last 36 years, which is as long as they've been measuring it. So, but the other fact is even more interesting. At the height of the most recent glacial advance, the ice on the land resulted in the sea level dropping 400 feet or 120 meters. So 18,000 years ago, the sea was 120 meters lower than it is today. The coral reefs had to grow 120 meters to exist today. And they did. And by doing so, they left 120 meters of calcium carbonate underneath them. And in parts of the world, it's even deeper than that, because it was mountains that were emerging, different reasons why. But the amount of calcium carbonate produced by coral is estimated to be about 50% of all the calcium carbonate that is created by marine calcifying species that make shells. And so that is responsible for at least 90% of the carbon dioxide that's been lost to the life cycle of the oceans and the air and the plants on land and all of that. And so that's where it went. And we have come along, and through the production of cement, which is made from limestone, calcium carbonate is turned into calcium oxide, releasing CO2. So about 10% of our CO2 emissions are from cement production, and about 90% are, and that is from the shells of old creatures. And 90% of it is from the fossil fuels, which is different than that. It's the living part of the plants and animals that were turned into fossil fuels. But Inder Goklani, who is a longtime civil servant in the U.S. government at a high level, he wrote a book on the precautionary principle. It was brilliant. And he's been in so many different fields of study. He said the other day that fossil fuels are the greenest of all energy sources.
Really?
And what I realized about that was I've been upset with the use of the word green for a long time, because it is purely a marketing term. It has absolutely nothing to do with anything substantial or technical or scientific. It's a color.
How then did you arrive at Greenpeace?
Because of life. Right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Fossil fuels were made by life.
Right.
That's just a fact. Life made fossil fuels.
They support life.
Yes, and in that sense, I'm not saying that fossil fuels are sustainable in the long, long term, right, but there's enough of them to last a great deal of time, especially now that we've learned where there's more and how to get at them and all the rest. Mm-hmm. You know, it was only a couple decades ago that they were talking about the end of fossil fuels.
Right.
And I and others knew that that was just a joke, but but books were written about it, et cetera, et cetera. And there's lots of fossil fuels still to be found, and some interesting facts about, but let's just look at the word green for a minute. In my previous book, Confessions of a Greenpeace Dropout, I had a little ditty that went renewable, clean, sustainable, and green.
Hmm.
And a lot of people think all those words are sort of mean the same thing, but they don't. They're very distinct from one another. Renewable means self-replicating, like a tree.
Mm-hmm.
Wind turbines and solar farms are not renewable, right? But they somehow manage to call them that. They don't make themselves. They don't grow in the ground like a tree or a food crop. So that's what renewable means. It's simple. It means part of life, basically.
And then like nuclear, for example,
is not renewable.
Not renewable. Okay.
Well, yes, but some people want to call it that because it's virtually infinite amount of fuel available for it. But
right,
you can't call it renewable because the plant itself is made of concrete and steel and aluminum and a ton of other stuff.
Right.
It's not
right.
renewable, but it may well be sustainable. And we'll get to that in a minute.
Okay.
So clean means not polluting. Renewable, okay. Clean. Clean means, and pollution is a value judgment to some extent, because nothing is 100% clean, right? So there's always going to be some things that you wouldn't want a lot of, but if as long as there's only a certain amount of it, it's not dangerous. And the poison is in the dose. That's the first rule of toxicology. And a lot of people don't get that. They think any amount of something that can kill you will kill you, but that's not true. Mm-hmm. Table salt is the perfect example. It's an essential nutrient, so it's essential for our life. But take a half a cup of it in and you die, because it will dehydrate your whole internals. So there are many things which are necessary at a certain lower level and then don't matter. You've already got enough of it, but it's still not hurting you. And then it starts to hurt you. So clean means having an environment in which you are not exposed to things that are going to kill you every day type thing. And we've done very well, actually, at cleaning up the air and the water. And Greenpeace had a lot to do with that, especially in Europe with the rivers being polluted by factories. We had a campaign there with a river boat that went up the rivers and plugged the pipes underwater that factories were putting into the Rhine and the Elbe and the Thames and all the other rivers. They were dead. Whereas North America, Canada, and the U.S. adopted pretty decent air and water pollution regulations in the early 70s. But Europe didn't. And so we corrected that in the sort of late 70s, early 80s. But okay, so that's clean. Sustainable means that it will last a long time at the present rate of use. It doesn't mean it has to be renewable, though, because iron ore is not renewable, but there's more of it than we could possibly ever use in a million years in the Earth's crust. Mm. So iron is sustainable, mm-hmm. although you have to have an energy supply to make it, but that can be nuclear, and it is also extremely sustainable, mm-hmm. even though it's not renewable. So sustainable is a really important term, because it isn't sustainable to overfish a living resource, even though it's renewable. Mm-hmm. It's not sustainable to overharvest a forest, even though it's renewable. So renewable and sustainable are very, very different terms. And then you come to green, which is technically indefinable, has no meaning other than it's good. Right? There's no other meaning. And so they just decide what's good for their political and economic agendas. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with renewable, clean, or sustainable. And in this case, with solar and wind energy, it has nothing to do with any of those things. Because I've said for a long time that all the wind farms and solar installations should have to be produced with wind and solar energy. They should have to make the technology with solar power. Then they would find out that there was no energy left to do anything else with, and probably not enough to even do that with. Because the mining, and this is coming out now, that Mark Mills of the Manhattan Institute is the expert on this, has calculated how much of all these resources, especially concrete for wind turbines, they use 100 times as much concrete as a gas plant to make a wind turbine of the same amount of output. But the real problem with wind and solar can be explained very quickly. Okay, you build enough wind and solar to provide the amount of electricity needed, 100% of it needed for the peak of a city and the industry around it. So there you've got it. Well, most of the time it isn't blowing hard enough to get the peak, and most of the time the sun isn't shining hard enough to get the peak in the early morning, in the afternoon when it's cloudy all night. That's for the solar. And for the wind, it just comes and goes in erratic patterns that nobody can predict ahead of time. And so, therefore, if you're going to use batteries, which these people are now actually saying that we can use batteries and get rid of all the gas and coal and nuclear, if you're going to use batteries, when are you going to charge the batteries? You can't charge it when the wind and solar isn't working, because that's the only thing you have that makes electricity. It's like people think batteries make electricity, but they don't. You have to pump it into them from something. Mm-hmm. So now, in order to charge the battery, seeing as though the wind and solar barely provides 1/3 of the energy at any given time that you're going to need, you have to have at least 3 times as much capacity now, because the only time you can charge the batteries is when you're also supplying the entire grid with the amount of energy that it needs. Mm. And then there's the batteries. That I wasn't even talking about the batteries there, about how much it's going to cost. First, you have to build 3 times as much infrastructure for electricity production. And that costs more than any of the other technologies in itself. They pretend that it's cheaper because of the subsidies and the tax breaks. Like when General Electric makes a jet engine and then makes a wind turbine, it can take the costs of the wind turbine and subtract it from the taxes that would be on the jet engine, even though it's a fossil fuel engine. So that kind of hocus pocus is going on all over the place. And then there are the mandates where governments force utilities to buy the wind and solar, even when there's cheaper energy available and more reliable mm-hmm. energy available. So the batteries are going to cost more than the whole wind and solar itself. But actually, it's impossible, because mm-hmm. there isn't enough resources in the world to make that many batteries. Mm-hmm. So the whole thing is a house of cards. that will soon fall apart. And it will fall apart when blackouts start in earnest. At least I hope somebody pioneers that so the rest of the world can avoid having to go there. That's basically what's happening on that front.
It seems like Germany is very on the cusp of pioneering that, given that they've gone away from that nuclear and coal, and they've gone so hard into solar and wind, and they're finding out now with their reliance on Russia and Mr. Putin for fossil fuels that this was really bad policy. But I want to get into someone you called your punching bag, a certain British narrator. And some of the falsehoods that are some of these other falsehoods that some of these other myths that are talked about in your book. I want to show a video of the leap. Let's call them the leaping walruses. And this is one of the things that's talked about in your book. You also talk about the polar bears. You've talked a little bit about that. But Devin, I wonder if we can show that video of the walruses and then have Professor Moore explain.
They'd be on the ice right now if they could be, but there's no option but to come to land. And they're just a danger unto themselves. Really hard to watch and witness this. It's just. It's just so heartbreaking.
So this is very hard to watch these animals destroying themselves, but this was popularized in certain nature series as being the result of climate change. But you reveal in your book, Professor Moore, that this is actually a complete hoax, right?
It's a complete hoax on so many fronts. He loves to use pretty women to wrench at the hearts of the masses. But first he says, the walrus's home is on the ice. No. It's true that in the winter, the polar bear's home is on the ice, but the walrus's home is in the ocean, where that's where it feeds. Usually your home is close to where you feed. They feed off the bottom with their tusks, so they cannot go very far away from shore. They're purely a coastal animal. Attenborough implies that going on the land is a last resort for them, like when there's no ice, when in fact the whole north coast of Russia loses its ice in the summer. And the walruses cannot go where it's 6,000 feet deep and stay on the ice because they can't dive that deep. They have to be on the coast. And that's why that place, the rookery where the walruses were filmed by him, is an official walrus sanctuary designated by the Russian government. Why would they designate a walrus sanctuary in a place where walruses didn't want to go, as if they were escaping from the sea because there was no ice? At a habitat level, that's a huge lie right there to begin with. Then he actually claimed that the walruses were committing suicide because there was no ice for them to be at home on, when in fact the reason the walruses jumped off the cliff, fell off the cliff. Walruses can't actually jump or leap. They can just roll. And they were escaping from a pack of about 30 polar bears. And that is documented fact. The polar bear pack was filmed. There's a town nearby. The people knew exactly what was going on out there. These polar bears are around this town because they just dump all their garbage outside the town. So the polar, like all bears, go to garbage dumps if there is one, and many places make it so the bears can't do that, but not in this particular area. And so that was the reason the bears were escaping from being eaten alive by polar bears, is what was the truth of the matter. But to wrap this up in such a tear-jerking sort of fashion, like it's normal for polar bears to attack walruses. They're pretty good at defending themselves, but I have lots of documented photographs and footage of polar bears attacking walruses in their coastal hauling out place, it's called. Walruses have been hauling out from the beginning of walrus time. And they do it partly to give birth. They don't give birth in the sea. Just like sea lions and seals, they give birth on a rock, basically, or on ground somewhere. And that is simply the truth of the matter. And he knows it. This is the trouble with the reason I dislike Attenborough so intensely is I don't mind if people lie when they don't know they're lying. But he, just like you gave that quote about that was a beautiful one. he knows he's lying about this. And he also knows he is lying about plastic in the ocean killing the birds. He says that adult albatross are feeding plastic bag to their chicks, mistaking it for food. There is absolutely no evidence whatsoever in still photography or video of an albatross feeding a plastic bag to its chick. But there is one photograph that I managed to find, which it's pretty rare to find these photos, of course, of an albatross adult giving small bits of hard plastic that it had selectively taken from the sea, and they're different colors, but they're all basically the same sort of shape of maybe 3/4 to 1/2 inch long and hard. They're not sharp. They've already been worn, and that is for the gizzard of the albatross chick to grind its food. He knows that. He knows that birds don't have teeth and therefore cannot chew their food and therefore have a second stomach called the gizzard, which is a muscular stomach that goes like this, and it has to have hard objects in it. And land birds all use pebbles, but there are no pebbles in the sea. So marine birds have a much harder time getting these absolutely necessary hard objects. And traditionally, marine birds have used bits of pumice that float up from undersea volcanoes. And they're very abrasive, as you know, like they're like a stone. But they're full of little holes, so that's the perfect thing. But there's not always an undersea volcano nearby, so they do that when they can get it. Normally, they would find hard bits of wood and nuts from trees growing by the sea that had floated out, like from the trees that grow in the tropics, right at the shoreline. They'd be putting seeds into the ocean. And about 60 years ago, they started using bits of hard plastic when it became available in the sea. And there's been tons of studies on these birds, and there's been no harm found from substituting the other objects that they were giving them with this hard plastic. They wouldn't give it to them if it wasn't the right thing, because birds aren't stupid. They do have small brains, but they're not stupid, and they know what to give their chick: food and hard objects to digest it with. And that's what they do. And he has these pretty young women going on about it, tears and the whole thing. And he actually is lying.
One of his other favorite myths are about the polar bears too. You sort of alluded to this with the walruses, but in your book, you talk about how the polar populations are actually flourishing so much that they're actually threatening human populations, people living in the north. You want to talk about that a little bit? That seems to be another one of his favorite myths.
Well, yes. I mean, to begin with, the Arctic is a difficult environment for humans because the polar bears would kill them all if they didn't have their sled dogs. That was what made it possible for them to live there, is that they had a large group of quite carnivorous type dogs to protect them from the polar bears. And they also hunted the polar bears, but the only way they could do that was for the dogs to go in a circle around the polar bear, yapping at it, nipping at its heels. And then they went in with a spear that was long enough to avoid the paw, which would take your face off just like that. You know, they really, the polar bear is half again as large as the grizzly bear, which is from the Eurasian brown bear, the grizzly bear that in North America came across the land bridge during the glaciations, just like reindeer and moose and wolves did and people did. And we don't know exactly during which glaciation the Eurasian land brown bear came here. But on the other side of the world, in Russia, where the ice comes to the land every winter, the Eurasian brown bear, when that started happening a couple of million years ago, they ventured out onto the ice and learned to hunt seals and gradually turned into polar bears. So this is called evolutionary divergence, where most of the Eurasian brown bears did not go out onto the ice. They remained in their terrestrial habitats, where they eat mostly berries and small animals. But a certain number of them separated into a distinct population that bred amongst each other out on the ice and ended up living on the Arctic islands and the shores of Hudson's Bay and other such places, where they evolved over a period of at least half a million, maybe a million years, into the present day polar bear. The thing is, the polar bear and the Eurasian brown bear can still breed successfully.
Really?
They're still that close genetically. Wow. So the polar bear is a really recent arrival on the scene, because that ice is a really recent arrival on the scene in terms of the long scale of time in evolution. And it takes a long time for a new species to evolve, even when the environment is changing rapidly. It's environmental change that drives the evolution of species to become different, because they weren't suitable anymore for the situation that was there before, and more suitable ones evolve as time goes on. But again, it takes millions of years for that to happen in most cases. Although the interesting example in the United States is the barred owl versus the spotted owl. They were the same species until these glaciations started happening and cut them off at the Rocky Mountains and the big mountain chain, made them into two separate regions, the east and the west. And as a result, they became interbreeding in separate places, and one ended up with bars on its chest and the other one ended up with spots, but otherwise they're identical and they can breed with each other still to this day. So they're very similar to what happened with the polar bear and the Eurasian brown bear, although that is a somewhat more extreme example over a longer period of time. The polar bear has evolved only because of climate change. That's the ironic part of this. There wouldn't be any polar bears if the ice hadn't come onto the Arctic. The Eurasian brown bear would have remained the same. So the polar bear owes its existence to climate change. It is not threatened by climate change. It owes its existence to it. And
incredible.
The fact is, the ice on the Arctic has shrunk to far lower levels than it's at now, not that long ago, during the evolution of the polar bear. The previous three interglacial periods, this is the Holocene. The last one, 100,000 years ago, was the Eemian. And then my book has the names of the two before that, which I can't remember right now. We haven't named them all 40 of them, but we've named the most recent ones. Mm-hmm. They were warmer than this one. The Pleistocene Ice Age is still getting colder. It's getting colder at the depths of the glaciation cycles. And that's all very clear in the record of marine sediments taken all around the Arctic. It shows that the temperature has actually continuously gone down, the low temperature. The high temperature hasn't changed that much in the last million years or so, except that this particular interglacial is colder than the three previous ones that are 100, 200, and 300,000 years ago. And so that says something. There's actually a lot of information that, if people were interested in knowing about it, they would realize very quickly that CO2 is not the control knob of global temperature. As a matter of fact, it is an insignificant player. The water vapor in the air and the water in the clouds and the water in the oceans and the ice in the Arctic and Antarctica are so much more influential in the changes in average climate around the Earth that CO2 doesn't even really matter. Now they're talking about nitrogen dioxide and methane, which are even smaller influences, which are overwhelmed by water in virtually every situation you can imagine. And in order to understand how powerful water vapor is as a greenhouse gas, it's instructional to go to a tropical rainforest versus a hot desert. And say they both get up to the same temperature in the daytime. And then on a cloudless night, but in the tropical area, you'll have 90% humidity in the air. In the desert, you might have 10. The desert cools twice as fast at night because the water vapor is not there to act as a greenhouse gas. Hmm. And water vapor is at least 95% of the greenhouse gas effect. Some people say 90, so okay, 90 to 95. Whereas CO2 is a very minor component. So water vapor overcomes the effect of CO2 in so many different ways that CO2 should not be regarded as having any fundamental control on global temperature. And you can see that if you look at the graph of CO2 versus temperature going back 500 million years. Temperature has just gone up and down through warm periods and cold periods, whereas CO2 has gone, boom, down. Mm. Again, because of the things I talked about previously, yeah. The fossil fuels and the coral. Mm.
So this is real science versus political science. There are a dozen different sort of myths that you debunk in your book, Professor, and you've gone through a number of them. But one more that I'd like you to hit on, if you would, is the connection between COVID-19 and the sort of climate catastrophe agenda. Talk about that a little bit in the book. Would you mind just elaborating on that a little bit?
There isn't any. That would be
that simple.
Fundamental analysis. Of course there isn't. I mean, they're still trying to hang on to the idea that this wasn't caused by human laboratory work. They're still trying that on the, what do they think we are? I mean, it's obvious.
Come back to Solzhenitsyn, right?
Why didn't the bat virus get out 200 years ago? There was people all around the place. And, you know, it's so ridiculous to say that came from bats.
The most recent thing is original. Most recent thing is there's actually a connection between a real connection between COVID-19 and the virus and a lab in Winnipeg. And of course, all this information is being suppressed. So this is.
I want to know why. There's no question that they're doing it, but what is the reason for it? They don't know. Well, they can't tell us the reason for it because they deny that they're doing it. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to live in this world if they're going to do those sort of things. I mean, this is really ridiculous. But I'm not a COVID expert. I did have COVID, and it was the sickest I've ever been in my life.
Yeah.
But I did survive it and have no real serious after effects. I think most of the after effects I have are from the booster shot I took after. Mm-hmm. I had actually serious bodily things happen to me with the Moderna booster shot. Mm-hmm. The Pfizer two shots I took from Pfizer did not have any noticeable impact on me, except that I got COVID after I got the first one. So I'm a living proof that it doesn't prevent the disease from occurring. And so I just shake my head at all that. I read about it. I try to keep abreast of it, but I never pretend that I'm an expert about anything around it. Mm-hmm. I just know it was made by people, that thing.
Yeah. One thing you are an expert on, and I'd ask you to talk about this a little bit, is this idea that millions of species are facing extinction due to climate change. This was one that really, again, many of the things you talk about in your book were a shock to me, because I'd accepted this as sort of a, you know, general wisdom in the public sphere. But then when I actually saw you make out the case, it made so much sense. Could you elaborate on that one a little bit?
Yes. Well, the United Nations people, which I was unfortunate enough to have to sit near in a congressional committee hearing on the extinction, they claim that even though we only know of 1.7 million species, we have names for them and we have pictures of them and et cetera, they claim that there are in fact more than 7 million species. That is the best estimate that scientists have come up with. That's how they put it, the best estimate. How they achieved that estimate is completely unknown, seeing as though these species have no names, no photographs of them, no actual, any kind of evidence that they actually exist. So then they say, okay, so that there's 8 million, nearly 7 to 8 million species, and they claim that a million of them will go extinct in the next 20 years or whatever. Well, 2 million of them could go extinct and you never know what had happened because you didn't know they existed in the first place. What kind of a scientific argument is that? And that's what they said in front of the Congress of the United States. And then after me and Mark Morano and I, gave our pitch, the Congress of the United States threw away the entire meeting and went and had another committee with these bunch of UN fakes and didn't invite us to it. And that was the official record of that subject in the Congress of the United States. That just happened a couple of years ago. And it's just unbelievable that they can do this. But, you know, it goes back for me to National Geographic, February 1999, an article in it called The Sixth Great Extinction. And we are in the sixth great extinction, apparently, like the dinosaur extinction, as it's called, and the Permian extinction. These extinctions wiped out 60, 80, 90% of all existing species. They almost had to be an asteroid hit. We know the one in Yucatan, the dinosaur one, the most recent one, was an asteroid hit. And now we are being accused of causing the sixth great extinction. There has been a pulse of extinctions mainly on islands caused by European conquest of most of the planet. They brought rats, cats, dogs, all kinds of different species that these species that lived on those islands just couldn't cope with, and they ate them. The new species ate them all. And so, yes, that's attributable to human activity. But it wasn't that many species compared to the 1.7 million. This is not a major extinction event, and most of it's over already, because what species were vulnerable have already gone extinct, and there weren't that many of them. And like the passenger pigeon, for example, the ivory woodpecker is a classic example of a species that wasn't able to adapt to farmers. When farmers came to North America, the ivory-billed woodpecker would come in huge flocks onto the crops. And as the farmer killed them, they continued to circle around the pile of dead ones until they were all dead, instead of escaping. Which you would think would be a logical thing to do if all your buddies were being murdered. And no, but they didn't. They stayed there until they were all dead. So that is not a very good survival technique. And I guess that's just the way it works. Mm-hmm. And because so many more species have gone extinct during the history of life than exist today. But while we're on that subject, one of the most interesting things about this whole issue is that we are, in fact, the survivors of 3.5 billion years of evolution, the ones that are here now. We made it through all the times when over half the species went extinct. Our ancestors made it through, because every living thing on the earth today, of every species, is the result of a continuous successful reproduction since the beginning of life. Or it wouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. It's not as if species just pop out of the air. You know, they come from a lineage that goes back to the beginning of life. And the ones that didn't make it were pruned off the tree of life and went extinct. And so we are the toughest badass bunch of species that ever lived, because we've lived through more adversity and climate change and volcanic activity and all the rest of it and wars. We've made it through
Adaptation, right?
Yes, through adaptation and survival, just basic, basic survival due to adaptation. Mm-hmm. And it's not just us, of course, it's all the insects, which are half the species on Earth, have all made it, because they all came out of the sea just like our ancestors did.
Right.
Everything that's on the land came out of the sea originally and evolved into all these creatures that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
So it is, I think, instructional to understand that we are one of the species, along with all the other 1.7 million, that made it through that gamut, through that incredible maze of surviving through every generation for hundreds of millions of years. And so that's to me, that's the miracle of life, kind of. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not an institutionally religious person.
Right.
But I am religious in the sense that I think it's a miracle.
Yeah, yeah. That is a very fascinating take, because it goes so much against the grain of what we're being told. That sounds like a success story. That story sounds inspiring. That is a story that could motivate people. But instead, the story that we're getting in the public sphere, especially in the media and from government, is this intense guilt trip that human beings are the marauders and we're destroying the planet, and that in some sense we don't even belong here. We don't deserve to be here. That we are a pestilence upon the earth. And of course, when you extrapolate this out, there are actually people who are advocating destruction and the death of human beings, our own extinction. This is horrifying,
for them,
isn't it?
Except for themselves, apparently.
Right, right.
I always often posit, wouldn't it be a nice world if there was nobody who didn't think that the people should be here? You know, what's the matter with these people? Why are they still here if they don't think people should be here?
Sure.
And and that sort of drives me crazy a little bit. But we are here, and we're not evil, you know. I mean, there are bad people. There's probably bad dogs too, I guess, you know, and bad bees. But I do believe that humans are capable of being nastier than most other species are to themselves. Mm-hmm. Mostly, I mean, war is the ultimate evil in the human species.
Yeah.
And is continuing to happen, even though I thought maybe we were finished with that.
Mm-hmm.
But nope, no chance of that.
It does a lot of damage to the planet too, doesn't it?
Yeah. Hell of a mess. The most interesting thing to me is that we are still here, and people seem to think we don't deserve to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts with fear, though. The whole thing starts with fear, which leads to guilt, which leads to self-loathing.
Yeah, that's the synthesis, and right?
That, I believe, is the train of thought that gets people to end up thinking that we are unworthy as a species. Mm-hmm. And where that comes from, I don't know. I don't have a lot of it myself. I'm happy being me and being in this world. I mean, what a gift it is to be a living thing that has consciousness and can see the stars and, you know, I mean, wow.
So true.
How did that happen?
So true.
How did I?
That's the wonderful thing about your book, is it does celebrate that. It celebrates life. In debunking these myths, it celebrates life. And it tells the truth. Well, Dr. Moore, it's been just an absolute pleasure talking with you. We've taken a lot of your time. We know from conversation before we started recording this program, you've been traveling a lot, and you've been getting through on coffee. But we're at the part of the show that we call the reading list. This is going to be difficult for you because obviously you're so well read. But I've picked out a couple of books in addition to the one we've been talking about that I'm going to recommend to people, and then I'm going to ask you to sort of mine your best ideas about things that either you've written or that you've read that would be very useful and edifying to people who are taking in this podcast. So we talked about this book, Fake Invisible Catastrophes and Threats of Doom. Just a brilliant book. I can't recommend this one enough. It's the best thing I've read on climate change. And as I said, it's a celebration of life and the truth. And I think people who read it, it will allay a lot of their fears, as Dr. Moore talked about climate change. Another book that I'm going to recommend from Dr. Moore that I've also read, and he mentioned it, is Confessions of a Greenpeace Dropout. This is described as being of a sensible environmentalist is Dr. Patrick Moore's engaging firsthand account of his many years spent as the ultimate Greenpeace insider, a co-founder and leader in the organization's top committee. He explains why 15 years after co-founding it, he left Greenpeace to establish a more sensible, science-based approach to environmentalism that he's been talking about today, and which is also elucidated upon in his more recent book. The next book that I'm going to mention is a work of fiction, but I mention it, I have to say, because he's one of my favorite authors. It's the late Michael Crichton. I love his books because they always start with they're science fiction, but they always start in some degree of science, you know. Like, of course, Jurassic Park was this idea that, dinosaur DNA was trapped in anthracite and from mosquito blood. But the book that I'm recommending here is called State of Fear. And it's just a brilliant book that tells a story. It's almost an allegory of the environmental scare industry. This book was written in the 1990s, but it's so prescient. And the plot is when a group of eco-terrorists engage in a global conspiracy to generate weather-related natural disasters to environmental lawyer Peter Evans and his team to uncover the subterfuge. I won't spoil the rest, but one of my favorite parts of the book is when an actor who's, I think, loosely based on people like Robert Redford and Leonardo DiCaprio gets shoved out of a helicopter. That's my favorite scene in the book. But anyway, I won't spoil the plot for you, but it's a wonderful book, as all of his works are. And as I said, it tells kind of a fictional story that still tells truth about some of the things that Dr. Moore talks about in his own work. So those are my selections. Dr. Moore, are there ones that you could add to that, to our reading list on gray matter?
Well, I don't read a lot of books late, and I read short pieces that are concise.
Well, that's great too. Yeah,
I try to focus on as much information as I can possibly get, mm-hmm. rather than wading through a thick tome. But I loved State of Fear. It's a wonderful book, and Michael Crichton is my hero. It's too bad he was a chain smoking doctor. not everybody is perfect. But that's why he died so young, and he could have been another 20 years.
What a pity!
It was a pity. He was a wonderful individual. Books. Oh yes. The book that's written that is after a Christmas movie. State. No, that's, see, I'm no good at remembering names anymore. It's a problem of being 75. Life. It's a book that has the word life. Wonderful Life.
Life. Oh, it's A Wonderful Life. Yeah, the Frank Capra was made into a movie.
With
Jimmy Stewart.
Jimmy Stewart. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, this book's named after that movie, and it's by, A Wonderful Life. It's about the Burgess Shale, which is a fossil deposit in the Rocky Mountains. And it's of fossils that were preserved before any hard parts existed in marine life. So it's when they were like jellyfish. So mm-hmm. it goes, like, almost all the fossils we have are the shells, not the actual organism.
Right.
And
Dover, you were explaining.
This goes back to 540 million years ago when the shells hadn't evolved yet. And so Michael Crichton, that's not Michael Crichton. It's a Wonderful Life by professor from New York, from Columbia University. And he says, if we turned evolution, if we wound evolution back to the beginning and let it start again, it would never turn out the same way twice. That's one of his brilliant ideas. Wow. Yeah, he is brilliant. Punctuated Equilibrium is attributed to his work. He put Darwin and Velikovsky in the same theory. Velikovsky said that evolution happens when catastrophe happens, like when extinction events happen and the environment changes quickly, then species change quickly. And so punctuated equilibrium means that the equilibrium of long periods where nothing much changes, because nothing does change much in terms of the environment, and then suddenly there's a cataclysm and things change quickly. So that was something he contributed, whoever he is.
we'll look it up. Have no fear.
I must have that book. It's probably upstairs, that book, in my important bookshelf.
Devin is very resourceful at this, and have no fear. He will find out who is the author of that book, and it will be on our reading list.
Excellent. Thanks, Leighton.
Yes, Dr. Moore, I want to thank you so much. You really are a national treasure. I hope it doesn't embarrass you to say that. It's just a shame that we don't have more people like you, scientific people, telling the truth to Canadians and the world about what's going on with the climate. I want to also express not only my gratitude to you for being with us today and sharing your mind and your thoughts and your books, but also I also want to express appreciation to the Frontier Center for connecting us and for giving us the opportunity to talk to you today and document this conversation. And so I just want to thank you. We're very grateful to have you on the program and really honored to have this conversation with you and to document your books and your ideas today on gray matter. So thanks so much for being our special guest today, sir.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.